Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions World Headquarters overlooking the glorious San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. Where do stories come from? Author Harlan Ellison used to joke that he bought his at a little story shop. It might be said that they come from a potent combination of experience and imagination. Stories that last feel grounded in the real world, and no matter how fanciful the imaginative elements are. It's one of the reasons I so love the work of Stephen King. His tales are set in a world we all live in, recognize, experience. And then when a door opens into the supernatural, we accept his flights of imagination. His characters are us, and we personally experience the horrors he has wrought because we live in that world. It's also one of the reasons I love the work of Clive Barker, who approaches it from the opposite end of the story. Clive creates surreal, deeply woven imaginative tapestries that are otherworldly, survive in a dimension other than our own. But he makes the unreal world real and believable by populating it with human and inhuman characters who feel genuine, have deep and profound feelings and experience. We know what it would be like to be in their interdimensional places. Stories feed us, express our lives, our loves, our fears, our desires, and our failures. They prepare us for life and insulate us from it. And horror stories, as we've discussed in the past, help us face our fears from a safe distance. They feed our dreams and our nightmares. Our guest, Helena Rain, has an incredibly diverse creative background in classical theater and film. She's an author, actress, screenwriter, and director, and her first American film as a director is the canny and wise thriller Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. We'll talk about her life in the arts after this. This episode is sponsored by Gravitas Ventures' new film, The Inhabitant. High school is a nightmare for any teenager, but Tara lives in the shadow of a harrowing family curse. Don't miss this horrifying reimagining of the infamous Lizzie Borden story. You'll scream for this chilling psychological horror ride. Watch The Inhabitant in theaters and on demand October 7th. So, Helena, you were born in Amsterdam.
Yes.
Tell me, both of your parents were artists. Were you brought up in a small artist colony? What was life like?
Sort of. So very, they were hippies, you know, so it was all very alternative. They really brought us up without a lot of boundaries. So, you know, it was all a lot of creativity, a lot of love, not so much structure. It was great because we could, you know, we could totally evolve and like be who we wanted to be. And I have really beautiful memories of my childhood.
Well, did your parents influence your interest in the arts? Did you want to, were they painters? Were they designers? Were they sculptors?
They were sculptors and painters. Yeah, they did all kind, and they made drawings, and my father did video art as well. Yeah, I think just to be in that kind of environment was super inspiring. So when I was six, I saw the film Annie, even though my parents didn't want me to see any moving images. The babysitter got really bored, and then she took me to see Annie, and that's when I told them that I wanted to become an actress. And they were, then they built me a theater in our house.
That's so pretty amazing. That's rather indulgent, but also pretty wonderful. And the choice you chose was to move toward theater rather than the painted or sculptural arts.
Yeah, exactly. I felt I did do a lot of, I still love to paint and draw and all of that, but I never felt a calling to do that as a profession. I do that to express myself, or I do it to give somebody a birthday present or make a little painting. But I never felt that calling, but it was very clear to me that I wanted to be physically present and a physical performer when I was young.
Yeah, so that was Annie, the John Huston movie. And what was it, a babysitter? Or you saw it on the stage? A babysitter took you to the stage?
The babysitter took me and my sister, because we didn't have a lot of toys, because my parents were so against, you know, they really believed in Rudolf Steiner, which is this philosopher. And he thinks that children should use their imagination. So we only had like wooden blocks to play with and stuff like that, you know. Babysitter got super bored with us because we didn't have a lot of toys. And then she took us to the theater, to cinema, to see it on the screen, the film Annie, the musical with the orphan who gets adopted by Daddy Warbucks.
Right.
And so we saw it on the big screen, and I up until then I had never seen TV. I was completely closed off from the normal world. So going to a theater to see, you know, to see a film was just a magical experience.
Tiny child and to see it on the big screen, that to be your first motion picture experience rather than as most kids on television, must have been overwhelming.
Oh, it was so overwhelming. And it was this whole world that I didn't know about. And also just identifying with that orphan who, you know, who didn't have anything but had big dreams. And also that she was really funny. And of course, she's also like cheeky. And I loved everything about it. And I also thought that she made that film herself. I thought the actress made that film. I didn't understand. You know? So I was like, I want to step into that world. You know, I want to be in that world. That's what I knew at that point.
And so from then on, you wanted to study theater, and you had classes where you were able to do this, and you're in an artist colony where I imagine that was encouraged by the people around you.
Oh, yes, for sure. And we had a huge, big house with a big garden, and, you know, a lot of people always around us. Like you said, it was like an art community. And so, yeah, so my dad built me a theater, and I started to write plays and force everybody to watch my plays that were probably super boring for hours, you know, but they were all, so open to it and loved it. But my father did say sometimes, like, I think he was a little bit afraid of how, you know, how hard it would be. Like as a painter or sculptor or a writer, you can create your own art. But I really said to him, I want to be an actress. I said to him, I want to be famous, you know?
Oh.
And he was like, oh, Lord. You know what I mean? he did say a little bit like, get it all out, like go get it all out of you in the theater that I built for you. But I think he hoped that after that, I would choose to not become famous or anything. Like I felt that he died when I was 10. So he never got to see my career or anything, but I remember him being a little bit like, I don't know, you know?
Yeah, so at a very early age, at 10, tell me about Anthroposophy.
Who's that? Anthroposophy, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Anthroposophy. Yeah. Sorry,
that's the language. I didn't know if I said it right or not.
I don't know how to say it in English, but yeah, it's a whole philosophy where they really think that a child, you know, should be able to be a child. So you shouldn't pressure it too much. You shouldn't have it do all the tests and all the pressure that is often on children now in education, or, you know, where they have to do all these tests all the time and are judged and get grades. So we went to a school that was also founded by people who believed in that philosophy. So you were basically teached a lot of creative things and not so many, you know, that's why I still cannot spell and my grammar is really bad.
And yet you're an author as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I love to write, but I need like help with the editing of, because I just literally did not learn that, because it's all based on stories and myths and fables and drawing and painting and all that kind of stuff. It's very special.
So at a very early age, despite your parents' interests in the arts and in spiritual beliefs, you wanted to become a Catholic.
I did.
Tell me how that came about.
That came about because I was so attracted by anything theatrical. And also, I think because we were raised also so free, you know, there was no structure. The church, of course, had all these rules and rituals. And because we, in the beginning, we attended a Catholic school because the Steiner school that they wanted us to go to, which is based on the Anthroposophie, was too far. So in the beginning, we for a year or something, we went to Catholic school. And I was like, because I loved all the things my parents hated, you know, like the rules and I just loved it. Like, I thought it was so intriguing. So it's so ironic, of course, when you want to give your children everything that you didn't have when you grew up, because they were raised both religious. So they didn't want that for us. But so, and then I said, I'm going to be baptized, you know, and they were like, what?
And you were.
And I was, because their whole idea of life was that you should listen to your children. And if they want to go a certain path, then you should just support them. That's basically, so they were there when I got baptized and everything. And I wore like a white dress, and I saw it as like a play, you know, or a
grand theater. Yeah.
Yeah, theater and like marrying Jesus. Like it was a whole story to me. My parents were literally like, what is happening? I loved it.
So the church was a big influence on you. Do you think you've retained elements of that upbringing in your artistry to the day?
I think that my my upbringing made me very liberated in a lot of things. You know, I think the main thing that I got from my parents was not to judge anyone and to really see that there's no good people or bad people, but that we have light and darkness in all of us. And I feel for the theater, for my work with Ivo van Hove, who's a big theater director, I think that is what connected me to him, you know, where he would do big classical plays and deconstruct them like Hedda Gabler or, you know, any Shakespeare play or whatever. And we would never judge a character, but we would always just show all the different sides. And so I think me on stage, I could be completely free and like they call me a stage animal, you know, because I had no shame in that sense, because my parents raised me with so much love and so much confidence, which basically is that whole philosophy. The downside of it is that, you know, you're not really equipped to live life in the sense that you have to pay bills. You know, like in the beginning, I didn't understand any of that. Nothing. I thought that people would give them money when they went to the supermarket. I thought they got, like, I didn't, they never talked about, they were against all of that. You know, they were like, society is just a construct. Like, they didn't like that at all.
So. Right. Well, after your father passed away, you moved to a bigger town, which gave you access to a theater school, which I imagine helped you bloom tremendously at that time.
Yeah, that was wonderful. I was 11 when I entered like a school for young people. They were very professional, but you had to audition for it. And you went there after normal school. And that really changed me. Of course, then I really, you know, started to actually learn the craft, like, and there were great teachers there. Yeah, that really, and then I felt so at home with all the other children. And that was really when I felt, oh my God, this is it. Now I found the right group. And now I can really develop my talent.
Well, I'm curious about the life of structure that you found and how encouraging it was and focused it helped you become. Because as an actress, you've done such a broad variety of things and character roles. But it seems like that structure is what you needed to really kick it off.
Oh, absolutely. You're so right by saying that. I think because that, of course, lacked in my upbringing, but this theater school for young people was very structured. You know, there were a lot of rules. It was all based on the idea that if you go on stage at 8 o'clock and people pay the ticket, you know, if you're not there or if you're 5 minutes late, it's not going to work. So they were teaching this to the very young children there, that, you know, discipline, classical training. And then after, when I grew older and actually went into a theater school when I was 18 in Maastricht, that is also the most strict theater school in our country. I really chose that path. I still struggle. Like right now I'm writing a new script, and then you have to make your own structure. And I find that really hard. Like either then I'm only working 24/7, you know what I mean? Or nothing happens. It's very, like, I love it when there's a clear schedule. I love that. I love when you need a lot of, is it the same word, discipline and yes, you know, and work ethic too. And that is what the theater gave me for such a long time too.
And as a writer, you don't have anybody but yourself on your own back with the whips and chains. Yeah.
Yeah. And I find that very, very hard. In the beginning, I'm like, oh my God, this is so great. I can do what I want. And then after 3 days, I'm like, oh my God, get me out of here. Where's the theater? Where's the stage? Where can I, you know, like, I get really scared.
And I started out as a writer, which led to me directing. And so there's such different disciplines, as you know. And for me, writing is a facility that comes easily to me. But so many other writers I know, it's something that they really have to struggle with. And perhaps part of it is that lack of structure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, it's a huge gift if that comes natural, I feel. For me, it does not so easily, because I think because my parents never taught me, and there was no structure in our home. There literally was none. There were no rules. So it's hard for me to create rules, and also to give myself to say, okay, now you can for a couple of hours do something else. You know, I feel that when you're working on a project that you're only making yourself, then when do you stop? Like, who tells you, you know what I mean? Like, that's hard. Like and it's also great, because of course, when you're in a flow, then you can just continue and continue. But a person also needs a little rest. Anyway, I mean, it's all luxury problems, of course, because we're so privileged that we can even make money doing creative things, I feel, you know, so I'm very grateful. But yeah, structure is a big theme in my life.
Yeah, so Groningen really helped you in that respect. Tell me about that first time that you performed on a stage and felt the feedback of an audience.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was very young when I went to like an open evening. I was a child still in the theater in Groningen. I just felt the same magical feeling that I had when I watched Annie. I think I felt then. I really felt, oh, this is, it never becomes so beautiful as the first time. I just felt completely at home on the stage. And that hasn't always stayed like that, unfortunately, because as you know, the more knowledge you get of something, the scarier it becomes. And yes. But at that point, I was so naive and beautifully pure that I loved it. I absolutely loved it, because something went wrong. I was going to sing, or I don't know, but the music didn't come, but I didn't mind. I was just...
You were there anyway.
Yeah, I was there. I was in the moment. I was like, oh. I mean, later, of course, in life, when during my career, when the music wouldn't start, as a metaphor, I would, of course, be so angry. But at that point, I was okay with anything and just really found my calling. Yeah.
Yeah. So when did you know that would be your calling and your living so that you could pay the bills at the grocery store?
I always thought I'm just going to do this. Like from the moment I saw Annie, I knew, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And I didn't really care at that point. Also seeing my parents being struggling artists, and they always managed to survive somehow. So I think I never really even thought about that I had to make money or be successful. Only later when I find out that it's really hard to get into theater schools, you know, that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people will audition for it and only 7 get accepted or something. That's when I started to become nervous. Like, oh my God, I hope. And then I find out that, you know, there's not a lot of work for actors. And then of course I become more and more ambitious and it becomes more serious, you know, and you become more scared also.
Well, in the Netherlands, work on the stage obviously would eventually spill over into film and television. So tell me about how that experience changed your profession for you, because acting for the proscenium is very different for acting for a camera that's right in your face.
Yeah, so I always combine the two, but my main focus has always stayed theater. I love being on film sets, and I loved meeting you know, all new people and great directors, but I never felt, especially in my country, that there were really good scripts. The film world in my small country is quite limited, and it's going better and better. But when I was young, it was kind of like when, you know, I had in my hand an Ibsen play or a Chekhov, and I would always think, compare that to the film scripts I got, you know, and I was like, I'd rather play Hedda Gabler, or I'd rather play The Taming of the Shrew or The Three Sisters than this weird script that I got. But I did love, I worked with Paul Verhoeven, which was intensely inspiring.
A Black Book. That was probably the first movie that you were a participant in that opened in the United States.
Yeah, it was. And it was one of the only international projects. I did Valkyrie with Tom Cruise later.
Right, and Bryan Singer directing.
Yeah, Bryan Singer. And those were wonderful experiences, because you felt that the world, also Paul Verhoeven, of course, being somebody who works so much in the United States, he has a very different vision than like a regular Dutch filmmaker. So I loved doing those things. And there were multiple directors, film directors, that I did really enjoy working with. But I just felt the, for me, for my specific talent as an actor, it was better to be on stage. I think also because I'm very physical, you know, and I'm very expressive. And I just think that
your hands aren't moving at all.
So I just think that like more mathematical way of acting. And also I think a true film star is able to just be in front of a camera. And I don't have that gift. I am so energetic. And so I felt I could just grow so much more on stage. And then when Ivo van Hove, he was my hero from when I was very young, I saw his plays and I always wanted to work with him. And when he approached me and I joined his company, he became, you know, he was working with David, but like he was starting to become big all over the world. And then we started to play everywhere around the world. So I felt very satisfied in my ambition as an actress, just being a stage actress. And on film sets, I could be a little bit lost. You know, I felt like, I don't really know what I'm adding here. I also felt on film sets like a very small piece in the machinery. Whereas on stage, if I decide to do something, nobody can stop me, because it's a live event. And I felt with film, somebody could just cut me out.
Yeah, well, and it's pieces of time, basically. You're making little pieces of time and cutting them together and choosing the best parts. You don't have a do-over on stage, whereas you do on film.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, now I'm completely obsessed and in love with film, but it's in a very different capacity, because now I'm a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Or whatever, I'm a director or whatever I am, but I love to be in that now. Like I right now I don't feel the need to go into the theater at all. So it's very interesting how that completely shifted in my life.
Interesting. Well, yeah. I'd still like to stay in the theater just a little bit to see what you felt your strengths were in the theater as an actress. What were the things either that excited you or that you felt best suited to attack?
I think I'm very good with classical plays and making them modern and real and contemporary, grounding them into the current times, together, of course, with my director, Ivo. But even before that, with other directors, my first role was Ophelia and Hamlet. So that was really my sort of like, how do you say that, trademark, that I would play all these classical.
You're doing Ophelia and the Cherry Orchard
and all of those things, and O'Neill. And I really felt at home in those old stories, and then looking at them and thinking, yeah, but what does that mean now? You know, who is Hedda Gabler now, or who is Maria Stuart now? And that really, I love that. I love history and I love all of that. And also I think what I can bring in it's a good feeling with language that you need for those kind of texts, you know, because it's complicated and heavy, and I love that challenge, but yet to make it very human. And I think the core for me of acting is no ego. You know, for me, acting is reacting. It has nothing to do with who, you know, what do I look like? It's only about reacting and being truthful within artificial circumstances. So I think my honesty, if you will, on my best nights, because I could have ugly nights where I was pure fear and ego, but on my better nights, I think my honesty was what was my skill, you know, to really make the audience almost think that it was actually taking place and that I was actually crying or making laughter. Or, you know, that was always what I heard, like very raw and honest and just without any vanity.
Yeah, on top of the skills and those abilities, it's also a great actor has no walls. You have to allow everything in and out.
Absolutely. And that is that's why I think both you and me know that that profession is very intense, and it's some super vulnerable and very shameful also can it be, you know, because it's so comfortable to have walls.
Yes. Yeah. But to be naked, whether physically or otherwise.
Yes.
That's demanding. And that's what you need to be a great actor.
100%. And when you do it on stage, it is also the repetition of doing it night after night, after night, after night, that can become very, you know, intense, and it asks everything. And so you kind of live, you kind of save yourself for the night, you know, because, you know, you try almost not to live. You go on standby because you know, like, oh my God, tonight I have to give all of my emotions and all of my physicality and all of my everything to the audience. And I might as well not move too much or feel too much during the day. So that is a very strange life. You know, you live really just for that. It's like athletes, I think, also, you know, you save yourself, you completely make, and then for those hours you shine and then you go to bed.
What was the most vulnerable you ever felt on stage?
I think it was when we started to really tour the world. And for instance, we did The Fountainhead, which is, of course, a very controversial book. We did a theater version of that, and I played this woman that has a very complicated sexual relationship with the main character. It's very sadomasochistic, if you will. And of course, Ivo van Hove, which his style is very radical. You know, it was all very extreme. And then there was one scene where I would undress completely for the main character. And in France, in Paris, people just all walked out.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And that was very, I remember that so well. It was, I mean, we also performed it here in New York in the BAM. And there was a lot of shouting from the audience as well, because The Fountainhead is also Trump's favorite book. You know, it's like, right, how you can read it in very different ways. But so here there was also very intense, but I never felt embarrassed here, because I could still feel that the audience really respected what we were doing, even though they had comments and they were like, ah. But right, in Paris, I remember I was like dying. I was like,
you're literally and figuratively naked in a very controversial story.
And then they were like, no. And
So turning to film, who were the filmmakers and what were the movies that inspired you?
I think a big inspiration for me is Cassavetes, if I pronounce it correctly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I love his films because they feel so real to me, and alive and energetic, and also the work of Gina Rowlands within those films. That really speaks to my heart.
A Woman Under the Influence.
Yes, that's my favorite film. Like that, I called my company A Woman Under the Influence. I love that film. I think that is one of the, you know, and I think a lot of actresses have that feeling. And then what is also has been a great influence on me is The Piano Teacher by Haneke.
Yeah.
That is Isabelle Huppert in general is just, an amazing actress, I feel. So that influenced me. But it can really be also Scarface, you know, like I have a very broad taste. I really like to see very, Yesterday I was watching Night Porter, or, you know, like.
Wow. That's so a controversial one.
I know. But I can also have a whole month where I only watch 90s films, or, you know, it really can be a lot, but
you love cinema.
Yes. I love it. And I really enjoy going to the movies, especially here in New York, where I don't know anybody. I'm very anonymous. You know, I can just sit there in the theater. I so love it. And sometimes even a film that is not, that I don't even find that good, I can still enjoy, you know, right, because I still see stuff that inspires me, or that creates a thought in my brain. Or so I think it's a very, I love it. I really love it.
Well, how does it feel to be in a city now in a different country from, you left the Netherlands where you are extremely well-known, very well-known stage, film, television actress, to be in anonymity? It must be kind of a nice cloak.
Yeah, I love it. I think it feels very safe because you go back to who you are yourself without all the weirdness of fame. You know, fame of course has its upsides, absolutely, but it also makes you paranoia and it makes you very aware of your behavior, and especially in a very small country like the Netherlands, and Amsterdam is like such a small city. But there were also moments, because I want to be so honest about it, when I arrived here, that I missed it, you know, that I was literally so lonely, and that it was like, and also I was confronted with how much I got used to it. I wasn't that aware of how much I had gone used to having that public persona. And
when everybody looks at you and they know who you are, and
you feel that
recognition.
Exactly. And you also feel some sort of weird, you know, that you can exist and that you are there. And here, you know, I'm just like, hi, and trying to make friends. And in the beginning, you feel like you're invisible. And that is, of course, starting over again. You just need to, but it is so good for your character because, you know, you need to really meditate and go back to your own heart. And you can't just like, it's very humbling, and everything I took for granted, I now have to rediscover. And I feel that's very good for my development as a human.
Yeah, yeah. Do you still act? Do you still feel the urge to go on stage or in front of a camera?
I do feel the urge to sort of be physical or something, and then I go to yoga, but I don't feel the urge to act anymore at this point. I sometimes do when I'm trying to write a scene and I was just taking a shower actually, and I was like literally playing out a scene that I'm writing, and I was like catching myself doing it. What am I doing? But I sometimes long for it when I have a little bit of a writer's block, or when something goes really wrong. I just long back to the times that, you know, I just go on stage at 8 o'clock and everything disappears. You know, yeah. It's like all your worries, all your pain. And also if you're angry that day or you went through something horrible, you can express all of that in those big classical plays, right? Because they're all about love and loss and death and sickness, and you can just put it all in there.
Yeah, that's great. Now, what led you to want to start writing and then eventually directing?
I think that life that I was just describing, where you start to more and more disappear so that you can be these people on stage, I felt I was just disappear, like in myself, I just felt I was going to be exhausted, you know, because I think it also has to do with the type of actress that I am, in combination with the intense schedule that we had with that theater group. We would literally play 1 week in Korea and be that, and then the next week we would play in New York, and then we'll be in London, and all the different shows were like, and when you grow older in that, it just becomes too much, especially because the longer I did it, the more shows I had in my backpack. You know, and
becoming
more and more famous, these started to sell, like, you know, everybody wanted those shows. And because I was in a lot of them the lead, it's just very intense. So I think that drove me to think, but what do I want? Or what is my dream? And
who is Helena?
Who am I?
You've got all these characters packed into your brain.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. And those themes that I love, that's why I was so addicted to that life, like sexuality and power and violence and all of those, and love. And I thought, what can I say about that as a creator? And then I I saw this documentary actually on Dutch TV about these prisons in which often relationships would be, you know, there are forbidden relationships between people who would work in the prison and the prisoners. And that got me really fascinated. And it reminded me so much of different classical plays that I did. I was like, oh, I would like to tell that story in a very abstract way, not realistically like making a documentary about that, but making a feature film. And that's when we started to develop Instinct.
Yeah, I've been trying to find Instinct, yeah. And I'm not able to find it in this country, but please tell me about that. First of all, as a screenwriter, but secondly, this is your first time directing a feature film.
Yes, exactly. So because in the beginning, people advised me to do a short film first, but that didn't really appeal to me. I don't know why. I was so arrogant to think, I want to start with a feature film. Also, I do think because I've been in so many plays, the dramaturgy of it all was very much in my bones, you know, because I know I've read so many plays and every night lived in those plays. So I could dream those plays, you know, and that is the best education, I feel. And so we started to create I worked together with a writer, and we started to create this story about, well, that actually existed, about a therapist who fell in love with a rapist that she was treating in the prison.
Wow.
Which is, of course, about, to me, that is a story about control and addiction and power and sex and gender. Very controversial, of course. That's why it's also not released here in the US.
Oh, but that's what I love. Yeah.
It's very taboo, and it's a sexual thriller. But and I asked my best friend Carice van Houten, who people might know as the Red Priestess in Game of Thrones.
Right.
She played the therapist, and we together founded a company called Man Up, and so we also produced that film, and we started to create the script. In the meantime, because I was still fully on stage at that point. So I was like riding in the wings, but a theater career is planned years ahead. So you can't just say like, oh, I'm leaving by, you know, you have to finish. And so in the meantime, we also started to develop a TV show because I really loved writing. So we started to develop Red Light, which is a show about sex work.
Amsterdam, of course, yep, with the most famous red light district in the world.
Exactly. And so those people, they were like, you can only do that if you star in it. So me and Carice both starred in it. I didn't want that. I already knew I want to stop acting. You know, at that point I was done. I was done. And so we developed those two things. And then it took us a couple of years, of course, to get together the money and to get it financed. It's all government money in my country. So, but you still have to go through the process to get it. And then the first thing that was financed was Instinct, and we did it. And the rapist is played by Marwan Kenzari. He is a wonderful actor. He's in the new Black Adam film. He does a lot. He's in Aladdin. He plays Jafar. He not only works in America, but they are amazing duo in this film. And I loved it. The moment I was on set for the first time, I just thought, okay, this is my new calling. This I love this. Here, this is what I always want to do the rest of my life. I just love it so much.
Well, tell me about the pre-production process. Your first time out, you've not done a short film before. You've been on film sets plenty, but here you are in charge. So tell me about the process of bringing it to the screen for you.
I think what was good was that the Dutch Film Fund, which is sort of the institution that determines who gets money and who doesn't, they were very hard on me and on Carice, which, you know, you can, that has two sides, but it was good for us because it really made me fight, you know, and I had to, they were like, why do you want to do this? Why don't you just, that's very Dutch to say, why don't you just stay in your lane? You know, you're an don't change profession, and you're, you know, act normal. Don't think you're all that. And so they really, you know, made us work for it. And I think that was good because we came so prepared. Like years and years of preparation. I was so ready at that point. And so I loved being in charge, but I feel that my whole history coming from hippies and communes and all of that, I felt I'm more a collaborator than anything else. So what I also really enjoyed is creating a dynamic in which everybody would feel seen and taken seriously, and to give the actors what I had missed on all those film sets where I felt such a little part of a machinery, to really give them the idea, even though that I have a vision and this is how I think it should go, but that they were taken seriously by me and could have ideas and make them feel safe mentally. And all of that, I just absolutely loved. And I also really felt that I had a story to tell. You know, I really felt, especially in the time of feminism and especially in after Me Too, I feel for me, it is incredibly important that we finally have that space now, but also that I want to talk about the gray. You know, I want to talk about everything in between. I don't want to talk about puritanical, this is good, this is bad. I want to talk about what is actually, you know, what I'm embarrassed about, what I'm afraid of, what is in me that I don't even dare to look at. That's what I want to put on screen. And because I feel that will connect all of us, because we all walk around with this like black box of fears and shameful things. And so I feel that a big mission, you know, but with humor and not to make it too heavy, but I do feel a lot of motivation to do that.
Well, the transition from Hedda Gabler to Instinct to a youth-oriented American thriller, Bodies, 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 which is so much better than that description would belie. It's a curious route to take. And I'm curious as to how you ended up doing this movie. You're collaborating with several people, collaborated on the script and it came together. But it's so clever. And you mentioned Cassavetes as an influence and all of the fluid handheld stuff. Technically, the way the film is made, you see that throughout.
Yeah.
But how did this come to be, from this highfalutin actress director to doing something that some consider a gutter genre, but obviously we do not?
It went like, so Instinct had this very beautiful path to all these big film festivals, and London was one of them. And then, you know, I got signed by an American agency, and they asked me, who do you want to meet? You know, and my first studio that every filmmaker, of course, says is A24, you know?
Right.
That never really happened. And I was like, whatever. But then they saw the film and they were super intrigued. So we started to have a dialogue, and then they suddenly sent me the script. And at that point it was written by Kristen Rupinian, and it was a very traditional slasher, you know, and it had a killer, and it was, she's a very talented writer. So there was something in there, but it wasn't anything that I would want to do.
Right.
But I did love what she did with The Game. I like, because that game, we call it Mafia or Murderer or Werewolf or whatever. We used to play that a lot with my friends. So, and the psychological warfare aspect of that, I loved. And also the idea of film taking place, because my first film basically takes place in a prison, right? So it's also very much limited locations. And this is, of course, only one location. And that is reminded me a lot of the theater. So all these elements, so A24 kept talking to me. And then at a certain point, I was like, well, you know, if I were you, I would make it more into Lord of the Flies meets Mean Girls. And I would make it more about the current times. And then they introduced me to Sarah Delap, which is an amazing playwright, very young. And just, I read one of her plays. I was like, oh my God. And then we just hit it off and we started to recreate the script. And I have to say, I think after all these, you know, intense roles that I had played on stage, I think I was also longing, and Instinct, which is also very heavy, and Red Light, which is a great, I mean, I'm super proud of Red Light, but I just finished that right before I came to America. It's also a heavy topic, you know, it's about human trafficking, and you know what I mean? So I was sort of ready to do something light and to do something a little more playful. And what you said, like, it's also a construct. It's a ritual slasher. Everybody knows what's going to happen. And somehow I also felt at home in that, since a Shakespeare play is also a construct, you know what's going to happen, but we're going to do it in our way. Yeah. So I kind of was intrigued by that. And then I could take my own DP from Holland, which is my creative partner. And so that's how it came about.
Well, I'm so glad it did, because you do bring a personality to it that is often devoid in this kind of film. And I'm curious as to how you found the house, because it's a bottle movie. It's a very difficult thing to do, to be able to keep a movie alive when you're in one location. You knew you were going to be there for, 30 days or whatever it was. How did you decide on the house, and where was it?
Yeah, so the house was in Chappaqua, which is close to Tarrytown, which is, let's say, an hour from New York. It's more like in a rural area.
Yeah, it's the Clinton's town. Yeah.
It's the Clinton's town. I didn't know that. I only found out later, but I had no idea. But I was very worried, to be honest with you, and nervous, because we had a very limited budget. We only had 24 shooting days. So I was completely nervous about finding that house, because Sarah and I, we could type everything up, but are you actually going to find a house that is that big and that has all those different rooms that we wanted and needed? And so when we found this one, I remember the locations, the people who found it were like, I don't know, because it's so deteriorated, because it was a huge, you guys call it a Mac mansion. It is absolutely insanely big, but it was so expensive. Nobody wanted to buy it. So it was complete. Like there was mold in it. Animals were living inside it. There were like mice floating in the pool. It was so crazy, but I didn't care, because I was like, we have every single room that we need and more, because what I love is the same, like in the theater, we have like the costume department and the technicians have their thing, and everybody has space to really be there and work together. So on top of all the rooms that we needed for the film, we also had rooms for the actors, and so that nobody had to leave that set. And that is what I love, to keep everybody close. And that is the way I like to work. So when we found that house, I was so happy. And then when we got it, because you know how it goes, you also have to negotiate it and convince the people that we're not going to totally mess it up. So we used it as a stage, it was incredible.
And so you didn't find that you needed to make alterations to the script because of the house, the location itself?
Not much. It was so huge that we could even build little sets within the house, So sometimes we changed the hallway, or we put a little fake wall, or we did stuff like that, because it was just the biggest thing. I would actually get lost. And you saw the film. I mean, we 70% of the film is shot in the dark, because the power goes out. And so we would have, and us coming from Europe, being so dogmatic, we of course love to really make it dark. And so it was often so dark, really scared in that house.
Well, we even call it dogma, right?
Yeah, dogma, right. And then there was a raccoon who was in that. It was a crazy house, but we loved it. It all of us really enjoyed. And also it was very appropriate for the time of COVID, of course, because you have to stay in a bubble. And, so it was a great way of shooting. And the main challenge is then, how do you keep it entertaining for an audience, even though you don't have, multiple locations and going to the beach or the forest or... And I think that was also, we had fun thinking like that and really thinking, how can I make it dynamic, even though we are in the same house all the time?
And it truly is. Were there movies that you watched for inspiration before you started?
Heathers was a big inspiration for me, which is an old horror with Winona Ryder, and has a similar tone where, there's violence, there's blood, but there's also humor. And for me, the humor was the biggest key into this, the dark humor. Also a movie I love, and it's kind of like hard to get here to see here, is Don's Plum with Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire. It's basically a group of young people sitting in a cafe talking, and it's absolutely beautiful. It flows. I love it when friend groups, because that's very hard to pull off, a believable friend group, and I love that when in Kids or Don's Plum, they really pull that off. And that was very important to me, to watch a lot of, or Robert Altman is also so good at like making groups. He's like, and everybody talks over each other. And I love that. I love that kind of dynamic.
Yeah. Talk me through the casting process, because it's a great group of young people. I mean, the only one I was familiar with before, of course, is Pete Davidson. And I think everybody loves to see something horrible happen to Pete Davidson.
Oh, Pete. Yeah, no, we really wanted a group that was very different, like people from all kinds of different corners of the creative world, because to me it was important that, we had people who were theatrically trained, but also people who had a lot of humor. because that is it's very hard if you want to create a film full of tension, that every joke, of course, takes the tension away, because then you're sort of relieved and you're like, oh, okay, well, whatever, you know? And so then you have to build it again. So I was very aware of that. And of course, the whole Cassavetes obsession that I have and my own acting history, I it was very important to me that, you know, the acting would be wonderful and that everybody would be believable and it would be organic. And so some of the actors we asked, like Amanda Stenberg, who is this amazing actor that has been acting since she was a very small baby child. You know, she was in the Hunger Games even as a kid. And wow. So she's so experienced. And then you have Rachel Sennett, who's a pretty new, you know, she did a great film called Shiva Baby, but she's not that experienced. And she is amazing in the film. And then we have Maria Bakalova, who's classically trained in Bulgari, who has an Oscar nomination for Borat. You know, it was such a wonderful, eclectic.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, she's not very recognizable in my film, but
no, I didn't realize that was her. That's a revelation.
Yeah. So all, and then Maya Hala Harold, she's one of the leads in an HBO show called Industry, and she's very classically trained. And then you have Pete, who of course is comes from stand-up comedy, basically in SNL. So I loved working with a group like that. And I think because the film also really tries to say something about our current times and social media and, you know, our lack of really being intimate with each other, but being overwhelmed by technology, I just felt it was really important that I found young people that also knew that kind of world, you know, and that could advise me also, because I'm 46, what do I know? So I would constantly ask them, like, is this funny to you? Is what kind of music do you listen to? Is this how you speak? Do you want to change anything? Do you have any ideas? You know, would you wear this? Would you, you know, is this makeup, does that feel right? So I really felt it was a complete collaboration between me and them.
Were you able to have the ability to do rehearsals beforehand where you were able to play things out, or would you rather play them? You know, Steven Spielberg never rehearses his cast. He just, take one is take one. How did you handle working with this young cast?
No, I was intimidated by the group scenes, knowing that these actors were all pretty new to me. And my first film I did with my best friends, you know, so it's a big difference. So what I did was I immediately, when I said yes and we were making my deal, I was so awake to say to them, I want to rehearse at the location for 2 weeks with stand-ins, because I knew I was never going to get the actors.
Right.
Never, ever, you know, because that's just not how it works. So me and Jasper, the DP, we did that. So with a group of people, it was absolutely wonderful. And why I do that is not because after, with that information, I'm not going to be a dictator and say to my actors, well, you know, this is what I found out. No, it's just that to have a starting plan. So, and for me to feel everything, to choreograph everything, to bump into all the things that were impossible or that we had to change or whatever. And so then when the cast was there, we also had a couple of days of rehearsing on the location, which was amazing. I would rehearse with them dry, as I call it. So just saying the lines, no emotions at all, because like Spielberg.
You don't want to use it up.
No, I don't. And I don't like that as an when that's asked of me. I can only give if I'm an actor, you know, I can only give fully if I have to, but not if it's like, and so, but for them to get it into their bodies, the blocking, that I think helps so much, because then they will just be more confident. And I also told them, learn your lines. I said, I'm going to approach it as a theater play. You know, you have to be able to do the whole film without stopping, you know, like, and they were so hungry and they were so into that, and they, and that really helped them, so that when we were doing those group scenes, because if six people are talking, it's really hard to know when your cue is. And but they could dream those scenes. And then if you have so much knowledge and if you're prepared like that, then you can actually tell them to let go and improvise and, you know, and make them feel that they're loose and that anything can happen in the moment.
And the way you shoot it is loose as well. It feels almost documentary style. You're not on dolly track. You're not... It's not a formal feeling, and it feels fresh and like it's happening for real right in front of you. Were your camera operators able to just catch things? How rehearsed was the camera work?
So my DP operated himself, which is so important to us. Sometimes we have multiple cameras, but in the end, mostly we chose for the handheld and him operating.
But also that the rehearsing before the actors came in is also for both of us, you know, it's for us also to find out like what is the flow, because if you want to work that loose handheld, you really need to know what you're doing, because otherwise it just becomes chaotic, you know. In order to create chaos, you need to create order. So that's what we did ahead of time. And then he is such a unique talent. If people want to get to know his work more, you should watch the film Monos. It's a South American film, incredible film. His camera work there is insane because it's all in the jungle and it's crazy.
Wow.
But he feels, he's almost like an actor. So he really feels, you know, if something really interesting is happening behind him, then he will just like bend towards that. So sometimes there were, of course, scenes where we were doing coverage and you know, where we had certain close-ups because I wanted to be able to cut in a way where I could really be in charge of timing since it's comedy. But we also had scenes where we were much looser. And I think for the actors, that is wonderful because they never really know when the camera is going to be pointed on them. So they will be full in it all at all times. And we would do very long takes. So it would never feel too technical for them. You know, it would always really feel as if you're on stage where you get the reward of really going through something, you know, every night. And with acting in film, I always felt it was so technical that I could really not use my talent. And so I wanted to create a playground for them in which they could actually, they know it's not a documentary, but it became very real, you know.
Right. And thank goodness for the advent of digital cinema, because you would never have been able to shoot 70% of your movie with iPhones.
No, that's crazy. That is, of course, the new time. And yeah, and that also, I mean, what was nice, even though, of course, it gave us a huge headache, me and my DP beforehand, because you're so scared that it's not going to work. People are not going to want to see a film in the dark, blah, blah. But in the end, any limitation, as you know, will give you such a explosion of creativity. You know, you just have to sit with it and figure it out, and you become, you know, I mean, it's such a cliche to say, but it's just how it works. And so I felt in the end that that was wonderful, and that really that limitation forced us to be creative with lighting and also with acting and be economical about it. And yeah, and create a lot of energy so that it would stay interesting for the people.
Yeah, I mean, this film has one of the most satisfying endings of anything out there right now. It's really, truly wonderful. But I would love to hear what it was like for you to sit in the audience for the first time with an audience seeing this film.
It was incredible. It was one of the most, I don't know, life-changing moments or something, because it was so scary to me, way more than with Instinct, because with Instinct it was of course my own idea, my own script, I worked on it for 6,000 years. It felt very it felt like a much slower cooking, you know, going into. And then Instinct is also a film where you don't know what people think. People are not gonna laugh because it's not funny.
Right,
it's so not- it's very, yeah, you're like, okay, well, I guess they saw it. And you leave the room. But with this, of course, when you're making this, you know that you want people to react, you know, because you're it's a full blown, ridiculous comedy. So the absurdity of it all, you need that to sort of provoke a reaction. So the first, of course, the showing was, it was on South by Southwest, which is a big festival, and they showed it in a huge cinema. And I just died. I never had so many panic attacks, not even when I went on stage. Never. I was like, and so when it started, from the start, it was explosive, the reactions. And that's what I love about American audiences too, because in Europe, they're much more reserved and very, you know, they can be a little judgmental. And here I feel, especially at that festival, they're so open and warm.
Yeah.
It's like the best way to, for me to be like giving birth to this child. Okay. I guess it's not, you know, so it was just the little moment where you can only be happy and relieved that, you know, at least some people seem to enjoy it.
Well, we've talked a lot about the comedy, but we should let the audience that's listening know that it takes its thrills and suspense and horror seriously.
Oh, yeah. I think in a way, of course, there's blood and there's some gore and there's violence. There's a lot of death. But I approached it at a certain point more like a murder mystery in a weird way than anything else. And
it's an Agatha Christie for millennials.
Exactly. And once I had that, when we were still working on the script, that really liberated me, because then I was like, okay. And so I thought the sort of marriage between the very sensual, organic, animalistic acting style, you know, inspired by Cassavetes that I was going for. But then on the other hand, a very mathematical, sort of almost banal puzzle of the whodunit. I love that marriage. And of course, for people who haven't seen it, I will talk a little bit abstract, but of course the ending plays a huge part in that, because the ending sort of makes it about human behavior and human nature, which is of course where I come from. You know, all my stuff is about that, and not so much about, you know, an evil spirit or a villain or something.
Yeah, it's very grounded in a very real world. And I so appreciate you coming on to talk about the movie. I love the film. I've seen it twice, and I hope that the audience just expands, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
Well, this was the most beautiful interview, I really have to tell you. You did so much research. Thank you for spending so much time and making it so beautiful. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Me too. Thank you, Halina. And thank you for the great work and just for being so terrific.
Thank you so much. And I hope that we cross paths again. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.